Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning, May 2nd. Hope you're doing okay, hanging in there. Seems like, months we've been quarantined. But just stay positive, and there is a light at the end of this tunnel. I know it. Every day, just stay active and stay positive. Anyway, I'm so glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time, and you can hear us online at 883wppb.org. Each show is turned into a podcast and distributed, and you can also hear it on my website at annliguori.com. Well, this morning, we will hear an interview I did with a golfer who many consider the greatest player in the history of women's golf, the great Annika Sörenstam. Now, Annika has 90 wins overall, 72 LPGA titles, 10 major titles. She's the only female golfer to shoot a 59 in competition, and just incredible when she did that. I remember that. And she also was invited to play in the PGA Tour's Bank of America Colonial Golf Tournament in Fort Worth, Texas, back in May 2003, becoming the first woman to play in a PGA Tour event since 1945, when the great Babe Zaharias played in a men's tour event. Annika did not make the cut back in 2003, but she held her own. And she did so well that in the first round, she led the field in driving accuracy and was in the top 20 in greens in regulation. She's been retired for a while now. And I think right now the emphasis really on Annika is with her foundation. She helps young women all over the world, and with not only golf opportunities, but with opportunities that develop their character, their leadership skills, and she just loves mentoring these young girls. And she has a huge brand. She has, you know, the clothing apparel brand. She has a wine brand. She has her foundation. She does clinics. When you think of players who have retired from the game, male and female, who have their own brands, who have really gone on to extend their business careers in a huge way. Well, you think of Jack Nicklaus. He is doing so much now, including becoming a golf course architect. You think of Gary Player, who does so much. You think of Greg Norman, who's done extraordinarily well in business. Obviously, Arnold Palmer did so well in all facets of the game. And you think of Annika Sörenstam. I can't really think of another female player in golf who has quite reached the level of brand awareness after her playing career as Annika Sörenstam has. And, you know, that's a huge achievement. And she works with her husband. We'll talk about that in the interview. But, you know, it's just an incredible, exclamation point about who she is, that she's been able to really carry on her name, her brand, for years after her playing career ended. And she's quite happy. She has two children, and they live in Lake Nona in the Orlando area. Obviously they're not traveling all over right now, but they're a very tight family. Her parents have a place in Lake Nona as well. And she's just really a lovely person. And so I hope you will enjoy this interview that I did with the great Annika Sörenstam. And also on this show, renowned sports psychologist Dr. Bob Winters. He's also based in Orlando, but he works all over the country and works with a lot of touring pros, male and female, and with a lot of juniors who are playing the game. And he provides insight on the psychological issues that plague elite athletes and the 9 most common mental mistakes of these elite athletes. So every time I talk to Dr. Winters, it's like it's just a breath of fresh air. He really is a lovely person as well. And certainly in these trying times, Dr. Winters, all his advice, not only for elite athletes, we can all kind of savor his words of wisdom. So I hope you enjoy the interview with Dr. Bob Winters. Okay, let's go over some of the revised golf schedule, all you diehard golfers out there. Then we'll look at horse racing and NASCAR. But on the PGA Tour, the schedule is supposed to start June 11th with the Charles Schwab Challenge at Colonial Country Club in Fort Worth, Texas. The first four events on the PGA Tour schedule will be played without fans. So you have the Colonial June 18th through the 21st, then the RBC Heritage in Hilton Head, South Carolina, then the Travelers Championship in Cromwell, Connecticut, June 25th through the 28th, and the Rocket Mortgage Classic in Detroit, July 2nd through the 5th. All four of these tournaments will be played. They'll be televised. There will be no spectators. For now, the first event with fans, where fans will be allowed back on the tournament grounds, will be the John Deere Classic in Silvis, Illinois, July 9th through the 12th. And then once this, you know, this new schedule gets kicked off with the Colonial, June 18th through the 21st, it means there will be 24 consecutive weeks of golf heading into Thanksgiving. And some weeks we'll have two events going on at the same time. So, boy, it's going to be jam-packed. Now, the shorter golf season means no one will lose a PGA Tour card this year. And the Corn Ferry Tour players, which is kind of like the minor leagues in golf, will have to wait a full year before having the opportunity to join the PGA Tour. There was a memo that the PGA Tour sent out to players this past Thursday and said players exempt for this season will keep the same status for the 2021 season, which makes sense. And, you know, the Corn Ferry Tour players will maintain their own status and will have to wait before being able to jump into the major leagues. The PGA Tour champions will announce this past Wednesday that their tournament will restart the last week of July with the Alley Challenge at the Warwick Hills Golf and Country Club in Michigan. So July 31st to August 2nd. So the Senior Tour, the PGA Tour champions, won't start until then. The LPGA actually won't be back into action now until mid-July at the earliest. On Wednesday, the LPGA issued their revised schedule, and the Dow Great Lakes Bay Invitational, which takes place in Midland, Michigan, is now in the leadoff position for the LPGA, and that's not until July 15th. So they've moved the schedule to July. It was supposed to start in June. So the final event of the season, their tour championship, moves all the way down to December 17th through the 20th in Naples. And the U.S. Women's Open in Houston, Texas, has also been moved to December. The KPMG Women's PGA, which is a major championship, that has been rescheduled for October. It was originally scheduled in June, so that's moved to October, all you LPGA fans. That's going to be in Philadelphia, in outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in Newton Square, Aronimink Golf Club, the prestigious Aronimink. And the first major on the LPGA Tour will be the Evian Championship, now scheduled for August 6th to the 9th. That takes place in France. So lots of changes, everybody. Lots of changes. The International Golf Federation and the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, announced Wednesday an adjustment to the qualifying system that will accommodate the new Olympic dates, which won't be until July 23rd to the August 8th in Tokyo in 2021. So, yes, of course, with all these date changes, there's always the problem of rescheduling all the qualifiers, all the tournaments that lead into these major championships and Olympics. All right. In other news, today is usually the day we all celebrate the Kentucky Derby, savoring our picks, donning our hats, and attending our favorite Kentucky Derby parties. While Churchill Downs announced in March it was moving the Kentucky Derby from May to September 5th, new dates have yet to be announced for the Preakness in Maryland and the Belmont on Long Island. The Preakness is normally scheduled for May 16th, the Belmont for June 6th. But both of those dates will be rescheduled, obviously. The New York Racing Association is looking to restore live racing at Belmont Park and later at Saratoga. Its plan includes no spectators. And, of course, additional health and safety precautions with only essential employees at the track will be instituted. Churchill Downs has received clearance to resume live racing without fans on May 16th. And Churchill Downs and NBC will mark the occasion today with 3 hours of coverage on NBC, including the re-airing of American Pharoah's Derby win back in 2015, which was his first win in becoming the first Triple Crown winner in 37 years. And NASCAR is set to return on May 17th without fans with an Elite Cup Series race at Darlington Raceway in South Carolina, the first of 7 events in an 11-day stretch. There will be strict social distancing guidelines followed, obviously. All right. Sports Interview with Anne Ligori is brought to you in part by Dune Jewelry and My Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. That's DuneJewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game. PeakVision.com. Welcome back, and my guest is Annika Sorenstam. Annika, winner of 10 major titles, 72 LPGA Tour wins, during a 16-year playing career, averaging 5 LPGA Tour wins a year, which is just phenomenal, and really considered one of the greatest golfers in history. I'm so honored you're with us this morning, Annika. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
How are you? How are you and your family handling this crazy time?
Yeah, it is. It really is a crazy time. Probably like many people, we're hunkering down. We've been, I think this is 6th week, I think. Actually, you're losing time and you forget what day it is.
Exactly.
We're in Orlando. We're adjusting to virtual learning. You know, the kids have now got information that they will not be returning to school this academy year. So we're trying to do as much as we can to make sure that they will be ready for, you know, next grade. You know, no graduation, no nothing. So it's been interesting. We try to be very active. We try to cook together. We try to work out and be healthy. And in Orlando, luckily, the course where we live is open, so we've been out a few times, and yeah, trying to just spend a lot of time together, quality time. We're doing things we haven't done before. We're playing a lot of cards and just, you know, doing manicures, pedicures, face masks, and watching movies.
Keeping busy, and now becoming, a full-time teacher as well, right?
Yeah, no, it's not an easy thing. I have even more respect for teachers and just really the social aspect that school provides to kids. And, you know, I must say, I think our kids are doing a good job, but it's, you know, it's hard to keep up with a 5th grader and a 3rd grader to keep all the different classes and courses and tests, everything in order. And we were trying to create routines. We're trying to create a, you know, not necessarily a school environment, but an environment where they feel like this is where we do our work. And then we have some playtime. But I would say they're more recessed than normal.
Well, that you're talking about Ava and William, your 2 children. And boy, juggling everything, being a working mom, brand Annika. We'll get into that in a second. But, you know, I just spoke to the great Gary Player, and you and Gary Player are going to be honored with the Presidential Medal of Freedom. That is incredible. How did you find out that you were selected for this?
Well, first of all, thank you very much. And yeah, it's been, I mean, what a surprise, what a humbling experience. You know, of course, it's been postponed. But the way it turned out, we were playing golf in, up in Washington in September. I was there for Annika Foundation fundraiser, and we were invited to play golf with the president and also a tour of the White House. And, you know, that's... I've never been in the White House, so that was an amazing experience and learning the history and so forth. So, and then after the round of golf, we were having lunch and we were talking about, you know, legends and of the game, and you know, Mr. Nicklaus' name came up, and then Tiger's name came up, and Arnold Palmer, and you know, those all three of them are have been previous recipients of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. So, and then the president just said it, and to both of us, you guys should receive it together. And it was just, it was a surreal moment. I looked at Mike, my husband, who was right there having lunch with me, and I looked at Mr. Player, and it was like, wow, I couldn't believe it. I remember leaving for the airport and just say, wow, this is unreal, of all the things I've achieved, and to be recognized in this, you know, in this way, and for my achievements on and off the golf course. It's just, you know, you think of my story of coming here, you know, as a freshman at University of Arizona, and then turning professional, and then starting my family and my business over here. So it's been, it's certainly a Cinderella story. So thank you. It's very humbling, and thinking of all the people that have received it before, what a prestigious group and what they have accomplished.
I want to switch to the LPGA. You know, it's going strong under Mike Wann's leadership, Annika. More tournaments globally, more prize money, and then COVID-19 hits and is wreaking havoc on everything. And it looks like the first LPGA Tour event back is June 19 to 21, the one in Arkansas, right?
That's what I think is on the schedule, yes.
Does that seem too soon for you? And do you know if there'll be spectators there? Or I haven't heard anything about that yet.
Yeah, no, I don't really know anything either. I think times are just so uncertain. And, you know, obviously things will not be the same, whether it's no fans or I'm not really sure. I mean, you have, you know, this is the LPGA is an international tour, and you have players from all around the world. So, you know, I'm sure there'll be some interesting logistics to deal with just from a travel standpoint. And, you know, they're talking about all these kind of testing. So, you know, I'm not involved, and, you know, it'd be interesting to see how they do it. We all know that they're trying to reopen the country and on different levels, and maybe by June it's time to, you know, start moving forward and start living, you know, side by side with COVID-19. But I'm not really sure. So I just hope everybody is safe and we do it for the right reasons.
That's true. I agree with you. Let's think of happier times. And I always wanted to ask you if you had experienced anything more nerve-wracking in your career or since than when you teed it up at the 2003 Colonial, being the first woman to play in a PGA Tour event since Babe Zaharias back in 1945. Was anything that you've done as nerve-wracking as that? As I'm assuming that was just so crazy from a nerves standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think I've ever been that nervous, and who knows if I ever will be that nervous again. I know for a fact, not on a golf course, obviously, but just, you know, to experience what I did, it was, you know, I look back at my career, and it's certainly a highlight of my career, probably top three. And, you know, it was just not necessarily just that week and, you know, that tee shot. It was a journey leading up to it, starting in January from the press conference moment where I accepted the invitational to, you know, to teeing off there in May, the 4 months that I had to get ready. I mean, I remember, it's funny, I remember some things and then some things I really don't remember. But I do remember walking down from the practice green down to the first tee with one of the guys I was playing with, Aaron Barber. And he put his arm around me and said, let's do this together. He was a rookie that year, and so was my other playing partner, Dean Wilson. So they, you know, they hadn't experienced anything like this either. So it was kind of the three of us trying to figure out how to do it. And, you know, when they announced my name and it was time to play, I remember looking at my caddy, and he told me later that my lips were moving, but no words came out. So he was probably wondering what in the world is happening here. So, but I remember just, you know, pumping myself up and say, you know, just hit another tee shot, you know, focus on what you got to do, not necessarily where you are and the circumstances. And then I hit it down the fairway, and I said, okay, let's just play. So, but yeah, it was an amazing experience. And I know I learned so much from that. And I know it made me stronger. And I figured if I can handle this, I know that moving forward with other tournaments, other majors on the ladies tour, you know, I'm going to be, I'm going to have some experience, and that would make me richer and be able to handle other situations.
You retired from playing on the LPGA tour, what, in 2008? And I know you're busier than ever. And you know, your working mother, your brand, it's called Annika. I love it. Yes. Your first name. You know, only who else has that? Madonna and, you know, not too many others just are referred to by their first name. So that's, that in itself is great. But it includes an apparel line, a golf course design, clinics, your foundation, the Annika Award. What do you think you spend the most time with, or do you kind of section it off and spend a lot of time with every little, with every.
Well, thank you. No, I would say that it's seasonal or depends on what time of year. Let's start with course design. I mean, that's, you know, when you have a project, you work intensely with it, and then you kind of go to the next phase, and, you know, months go by and you don't do much with it. Clothing, you know, we have three big meetings a year where we discuss the collection, and so then it gets a little intense, and then with photo shoots and so forth. But in between it, there's not much, you know, when it's in production and starting the distribution. The foundation, I would say, is where I spend most of my time. We now have 7 global tournaments, and what I mean by that is, I mean, it's global. It's in Europe, it's in China, it's in Australia, New Zealand, and Latin America, and then obviously here in the U.S. So I go to all 7 of them, and I spend time with the girls, and either I do clinics, or we have a welcome dinner, or we do, you know, our tagline is more than golf, so we would do something fun. You know, it could be, for example, in Argentina, we had a tango show. In China, we have had different performances on stage, singing contests, and just to kind of, you know, break it up and have some fun, because, you know, life is not just about hitting golf shots and making putts. It's about the friendship that they cultivate and, you know, being with other girls and push themselves. So it's been really fun. I mean, that's probably one of the things that I miss now being here is, you know, we've had to cancel already 2 of our events, one in China in February, and then Sweden, which was supposed to be in June. So we have postponed, or I should say canceled this year, and we will, you know, regroup next year. But, you know, I enjoy spending time with these young girls, and, you know, we honor a few of them, especially through the Annika Award presented by Stiefel. It's been, you know, Maria Fassi last year, and then we've had Leona Maguire, and we've had Bronte Law, just to mention a few, Allison Lee, and they're all gone, you know, on their professional path. And to be able to look back and look at them in their college shoes and see their development and then how they mature and move on, it's been really, really fun to see that. And, you know, this year is our 12th year. So you can imagine we've had thousands of girls, you know, go through our programs. We have over 600 a year that goes through them. We've had over 55 turn professional, and so it's been this whole tournament initiative and trying to inspire the next generation. It's been really fun to be around and see it grow. And you'd be surprised when you go to some of these areas that they don't have girls invitational only. Like in Latin America, we're now in our fifth year, but our first year, this was the only girls' invitational. Normally, they start a boys' event, and then they invite some girls on the side. So this is the only girls' event, which is amazing to me when you think of 2020. And therefore, we get a lot of support from the regions and the different countries, and all the coaches from the U.S. go down there, and they get another chance to recruit some top players. And it's amazing to see some of these young girls, playing well, and all, sure. They leave with a scholarship somewhere. So I'm very happy for them and happy to be able to provide that platform for these girls to fulfill the dream, kind of like what I'm living my dream.
Right. I mean, it sounds so, I can hear the passion in your voice about it. Do you think you're more passionate now as a brand Annika and everything that you're working on than when you were playing? It's a different kind of life, but how many players can say that they've really gone on to establish such a big brand and doing so many things? And you're just, you love what you do. Post your
I do. Yeah. No, I do love what I do. I mean, I love playing. I mean, I love being out there, being competitive, and because I'm very competitive, and fulfilling my dreams, and being number one in the world, and all the things we talked about. But when I stepped away, it was time for several reasons. One of them was I was getting married. I want to start a family. The other one was I had achieved what I wanted to achieve, and number three was I have a desire to help others. How can I get other girls to have this opportunity that I'm having? I knew pretty quickly that we were going to have a foundation with girls golf international income, and competitions. And then we added all the other things in with the clinic that I do, and the workshops that we do for these girls, whether we have a session talking about fitness or nutrition or maybe the importance of sunblock or whatever. We do different topics every tournament. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know how many, I don't really see so many other the professionals, taking that step. I know Lorena is very involved in her school and does amazing things in Mexico. But sure. I think, Lorena, I found the niche. Yeah, correct. Sorry. But I found, my niche, and I love doing this. And I build up a great relationship with these young girls. We keep in touch. And I still get calls from some of the players that have turned professional, and they just want to have somebody to brainstorm with. For example, how does it work with caddies out here, and how does it work with sponsors? I mean, these young girls are at a very sensitive age in a way. We have tournaments for girls that are 12 to 18, and in the middle of that is where, a lot of things happen, a lot of developments happen in a young girl's life. A lot of it is other than sports, and they have a lot of responsibilities. People pull them left and right, whether it's school or girlfriends or boyfriends or technology, a lot of distractions. So to be able to keep them on the path, to be able to inspire them to fulfill their dreams. And we're not just talking about being a professional golfer. We're talking about just human beings and having, learning how to set goals to a successful future, whether it's into law or being a doctor or a teacher or just, being a complete human. So it's been very rewarding for me, and I feel like I learned as much as I can, give back. It's really been more that I have received than I've been giving. So I feel very lucky about that.
Sure. Just very important work, Annika. And you work with your husband. Mike McGee is the managing director of Annika, your brand. What's it like working with your husband?
Well, we get along.
Any arguments?
Well, he's very good at saying, yes, dear. So here we go. I think those are the key words. But I respect him tremendously. He works very hard. And, we both have our, family interest in mind. So, when I have to go somewhere, he knows why I'm going, and he probably set up the outing. That's why I'm going. So, I think we complement each other very well, his weaknesses, and then I cover it with certain things, and then I have weaknesses, and he covers me. So it's fun. I mean, I he was an agent before, and he worked with tournaments before. So he has, the background, his dad played on the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour. So he has the competitive background, and he was a great athlete himself. And so, yeah, it's fun. I mean, we, you know, we have moments where we work, and then we also say, okay, this is not work. But I think the hardest part is we love what we do, so it gets a little mingled sometimes when you sit at the table and you might, you know, throw a little business question. But overall, it's like we know when it's time to do that, and then we spend time with the kids. And I think it's really important for the kids to see that, you know, that both parents work and that it takes hard work and commitment and dedication to achieve things in life. So, you know, they see that we work together, it's teamwork, and you do better that way. Thank you very much for your support and your friendship and having me on your show.
Thanks so much, Annika Sorenstam. Sports Interview with Anne Ligori is brought to you in part by Dune Jewelry and My Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. That's DuneJewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game. PeakVision.com. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Ligori, and my guest is Dr. Robert Winters, who is a sports psychologist, not only any sports psychologist, but he's been working with golfers, professional golfers, and doing his thing since 1977. And he has a book called Mistake-Free Golf, a first aid for your golfer's brain, and he lives right around the corner. So this tournament, the Arnold Palmer Invitational here at Bay Hill, is right in your own backyard. So it's good to see you at home here, Doctor.
And it's great to be on the show. You're just a living legend. It's great to be here. And you and I have known each other now for a few years. And so I'm just glad we can actually do this interview.
Well, I mean, this is the epitome of golf, Orlando, Florida, right? So tell me a little bit about your background. How long have you been here? I know you're working as the resident sports psychologist for David Ledbetter. So, I mean, you're so connected to the sport. Have you always been in Orlando, or what's your background?
Well, my background is I grew up in the middle of Midwest, Indiana. I played golf for Ball State University. I played golf at every professional level, you know, both as a tour player, as a Champions Tour player, PGA Champions Tour qualifier. I helped start the Nike golf schools back in 1991, 92, the junior golf programs all over the nation. I was the assistant men's golf coach at the University of Virginia for 10 years, and been involved with golf all my life, you know, as a player, as a coach. So I became a sports psychologist many, many years ago in order to help my own game. So we always say, doctor, heal thyself. Well, that's exactly what I did. So everything that everyone is afflicted with, I have had. I've cured myself and cured everybody else, and it has been one great, great ride, Anne. Really.
I bet. I mean, I saw you at Rich Lerner's celebrity tournament last year, and everybody knows your name, Dr. Winters, in the world of golf. And, you know, you've coached some incredibly successful players. One, Brooks Koepka. I mean, the guy's a machine. You coached, you were his sports psychologist when he was a youngster and when he was at FSU. Talk a little bit about your work with Brooks Koepka.
Well, one of the things that his coaches, high school coaches and college coaches, knew that he had a temper. I mean, this guy wasn't just a golfer. He was an athlete, a baseball player. I think his father, Bob, you know, was a professional baseball player. So he had a real, like, in-your-face, chip-on-your-shoulder attitude. So as far as mental toughness, I mean, he got that both from his mom and his dad. His mother, Denise, fantastic woman, a cancer survivor. And he, you know, and his little brother, Chase, who's also a tournament golfer, plays on the European Tour and all over the world. They've been very, very close, great family, and that's where Denise said, I need some help with Brooks. He's got kind of an anger management issue problem, and it wasn't so much anger. He just gets frustrated, and that's really what great players do. When they get frustrated, when their results don't match their expectations, they get disappointed, disgusted, angry, and I'll tell you what, sometimes even depressed. And that's where we have to remove the expectations and start focusing on execution. And that was my work with Brooks. Now, if you listen to him to this day and time, he's always talking, I don't care about anybody else. I take care of me. It's about me, my ball, and the target, and we beat the golf course. And there's some other people who have done that who've been pretty successful, like Tiger Woods and Jack Nicklaus and Annika Sorenstam. But if you can actually beat the golf course, everything else falls in place.
And how hard hard is that to, you know, that to make that connection with a youngster who, you know, golf is such a frustrating sport, more than any other sport I can think of. How do you get somebody with that much talent not to be frustrated? Because golf is so different. You can hit a great shot 1 second. The next second, you could look like a total beginner, and this is a professional golfer, right?
Right.
So how does one make that connection to somebody so young to not lose your temper?
I think Lee Trevino said it best. He said, I'm only going to take a lesson from somebody that can beat me. And so when I start seeing these junior golfers through my junior programs, the Ledbetter Academy, Nike Golf Schools, I sort of talk the talk and walk the walk. So I will go out and role model, sort of what we call participant modeling. I will show them, this is what I need you to do. A lot of people call me the original sugar pop guy, all right? They call me, you know, pretty positive. But I'm not positive. I'm very purposeful. I'm very realistic. I'm very specific. But I say, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. And when young people, especially, you know, the juniors, because they're so critical, and they sort of discern things very, very easily, very quickly, and they size you up. When they find out I'm just not a psychoanalyst or psychologist, I'm an athlete, I'm a coach, I'm a real person, and I walk the walk, talk the talk, and I do exactly what I say I'm going to do, and they go, huh, this sounds fun. Plus, I keep it enjoyable. You know, I keep it lighthearted, and that's why we say they're fundamentals. It's fun, duh, mentals. That's really what we call it. It's, yeah, that's how we keep it fun. We just keep it, hey, it's just mental. Let's go out and have a great time. And when you help people have a great time, whether they're learning something in life and business or whatever, they will be invested, and that's really what I do.
I like that. Keeping on the Brooks Koepka theme for a second, because I always thought he was an amazing talent. He did not get the recognition early in his career after he won his first U.S. Open, his first major title, Erin Hills. When he went to Shinnecock as the defending champion, he was not too happy because he wasn't getting the recognition that most defending champions would get. I think it was because he was coming across, you know, with that chip on his shoulder to the media. So I'm not sure if you've worked with him recently. Now, obviously, people know who Brooks Koepka is. They're giving him all the credit in the world for winning, you know, what, 4 majors at this point in a very short period of time. But that kind of carried over that chip to the way he was dealing with the media.
Well, I think sometimes you like to back yourself into a corner because you fight your way out of it. And Brooks has heard from me from a long time, as I, all of my tour players and all my college players, is that if you're the defending champion of something, of any major, of any tournament, you have to give up the defense. Quit defending something that they cannot take away from you. I mean, if you won that 1 year, let's go out, let's get the next one. Let's quit being the defending champion. I would say the same thing to Tiger Woods right now about going down to Augusta here in a few weeks. Give up the defense. You've already won this several times. Let's go out and get this one. And so you're always moving forward. I always like to call it sort of a panzer tank approach. It's just tanky, 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 tanky. You're just moving one after one after one, and you're just not holding on to anything. You're always moving forward. So that's a very smart, aggressive strategy, because everyone's always asking people, how do you close the deal? How do you win? When you let go of winning and perform and execute and play it one after one until you're done, winning tends to come knocking at your door.
And you don't care what if you've gotten the recognition that you feel you deserve, because it's not about that. It's about going out there and playing the best you can.
Oh, absolutely. So I think, you know, Brooks sort of likes this, you know, oh, hey, you know, I'm not getting the recognition. It puts him in a position of, I'm going to show you this. And that's really what Gary Player said years ago. He said, you always want to thank the people who are very positive, very supportive of you. He said, but you also want to thank the people that say, no, you're not good enough. We're going to overlook you, because you just can't wait to show them up. And I think that's kind of really what Brooks Koepka does. And I think it's also really what one Patrick Reed is doing right now, because he has sort of backed himself into an unbelievable corner, and really he has himself, his family, and his own thoughts. And that's really what sort of gives him that cocoon, and that's what gives him that bubble of concentration. It's going to be me you know, my ball against the world. And so far, he's been pretty successful with that.
Do you work with Patrick?
No, I do not. But if he called, you know, I would probably have to consider it, because he really is an interesting case study, interesting athlete. And a lot of people have said, wow, you know, what's going on there? So I don't really like to speculate on this. I think time will be, you know, the ultimate judge here. But I got to tell you, I mean, here he is, a major champion. He's won a lot of these world championships. He's a hell of a player. Some people call him Captain America. Some people call him, I think David Faraday called him Captain Oblivious, because he's really not even aware of his own detrimental self-image. Sometimes people are famous, sometimes they're infamous. But that's the great thing about this sport. You got different strokes, different folks, and no one person is alike. So that's what I love about my job, because every day I come into my office or people call me up, it's something new. It's something that we have to custom tailor for them. And I work on the human being model. I don't really have one size fits all. But I do know one thing, if everybody's listening to this broadcast, if there's one thing you can do, is the first thing before you step up on that tee or on that floor or on the ice, is that, are you going to believe in your talent? Because that's the number one mental mistake we have in life, is that we have our own self-doubt. And where's that doubt created? It's within our own minds. And I always tell people, that's the first thing I ask them.
I think he knows, obviously, what's going on, but I don't think anybody does a better job at using the distractions and tunneling those distractions into focusing on wanting to play great golf. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. Some people might let that really affect them on the course and off the course. All the things going on off the course affect their play, but Patrick Reed almost feeds off of it.
Well, when people ask me, they go, well, what do you do? Is golf 100% mental? Is it 50-50? And I tell them, I thought this was pretty interesting. I said this in my a book before Mistake-Free Golf, The 10 Commandments of Mind Power Golf that I had written. I said, golf is 100% mental and 100% physical. And I realize now that Ben Hogan had said that 25 years earlier, but I thought I was pretty smart at that time. But now I'm going to say it's 100% mental, 100% emotional, 100% physical, and now, Ann, I'm going to say it's 100% compartmental. Is that I think players, any athlete, any great business people, people who are very successful, they compartmentalize. They can shut out and disconnect and focus on what they have to do. Because if you can do that, then you have total control. You see, that's the whole problem with doubt. Doubt is our number one performance enemy. And if people can actually get you to doubt your talent, then they can control you. All right, so that's why I'm always trying to give people, you know, get in control. Control what you can control. Forget everything else. Get in your little bubble of concentration, and let's go out and let's perform, and let's find out how great we can be.
Vince Lombardi, I love it. I'm ready to go out there and win the game, man. Can we keep talking about this? You got me all pumped up. Well, Mistake-Free Golf, First Aid for Your Golfer's Brain, came out a couple years ago, and it's a gem. It has so many pearls of wisdom in it, and your focus really is on the 9 most common mental mistakes that golfers make, or I would assume any athlete would make. You say self-doubt is one of them. What are some of the others?
The other ones, you know, I try to be perfect. I hit the shot when I know I'm not ready. I worry about my reputation. I worry about my score. I have too much thinking. I've got helmet fire. I've got all this stinking thinking going on in my head. So I address each one of these, because so many of these self-help psychological, sports psychology books in particular always talk about sort of this is the condition, but they never say this is the treatment. This is what you have to do. That's why I say this is first aid for your golfing brain. This is what you need to do. And that's what made Nike so successful. They had 3 words: just do it. And that's really what I'm doing in this book. I'm giving you a very nice prescription for success. And at the end of every chapter, I say, I need you to do this. And if you can do these things and really comply and do the things I'm asking of the player to do, you will have success. And that's really really what, you know, confidence is all about. Confidence isn't just thinking confidence. It's actually attracting confidence. It's creating confidence. But it's doing the things that you have to do in order to be successful. And if you're successful at little baby steps at a time, at the end, the residue of all that success will be what we call long-term enduring confidence. And that's really what I do. I build confidence.
I love that. You build confidence. So you could be talking to CEOs. Yep. You could be talking to race car drivers. You could be talking to doctors, nurses. I mean, I think that concept is so important because everybody has that self-doubt, Dr. Winters. How do you tear that down in somebody?
How do I tear down?
The self-doubt.
The self-doubt. Well, self-doubt starts with a little seed of self-doubt. People go, you know, am I really that good? You know, why don't I have what everybody else does? Everybody's always looking on the other side of the fence. And they start sort of tearing themselves down. You don't have the option or the luxury of thinking negative thoughts. You know, what you say to yourself is what you become. I mean, that's the strangest secret of all. Earl Nightingale said that back in 1953. So what I'm trying to do today is say, hey, you improve your self-talk, you improve your self-thought, you really say, this is what I want to be. And I hear a lot of these self-help gurus say, well, you've got to fake it till you make it. I don't like that. I don't like that because that's false, you know, deception, creating a false perception. I say, do it until you become it. And you have to do the little things every day in some little manner to help you become more competent so you can become more confident in everyday life. And it just transfers into every area of life. And that's why I love to speak to corporations. I love to speak to businesses. Whoever, you know, really wants to have a sort of a different view on confidence, you know, let them come to Dr. Bob Winters.
Is there a problem being overconfident?
There can be if you believe that you're too big for your britches, so to speak. So we always talk about sort of this confidence bias. Here's the point, and Ann, I'll tell you straight up, is that I think being overconfident is not as big a problem as being underconfident. Because if you're always underconfident, you're always underperforming, and you're never giving yourself a chance to find out how great you can be. I always love it, you know, when somebody walks in to a social gathering, and they may not be, you know, the prettiest, the most glamorous, the person that has the most bling, but you can just see that positivity, that confidence, and they come out and go, you know what, I may not be the hottest thing since sliced bread, but I'm pretty hot anyway, you know, and you have that, and they come out, they exude that self-confidence, that self-image that says, I like who I am. And when it all comes down to confidence, it means, are you comfortable in your own skin? Do you like who you are? Do you like, you know, where you're at? Do you like what you aspire to be? And are you moving towards that direction? And that's really what I think, you know, this life's all about, is finding out how great we can be.
I always took issue with people in the media or fans who thought if a player said something that sounded a little cocky, that, oh, what's that? Why should he say that? You know, Brooks years ago, you know, came across cocky. I always defended him because if you want to be a champion, you have to have that overconfidence. I didn't find it to be offensive at all. I just found it to be, as you say, an example of somebody who really believes in themselves. Now, you know, it may be keep it to yourself, or you're going to offend somebody, but or maybe not even worry about it.
You see, here in America, especially America, and even in Australia, Australia calls them the tall poppies. Oh, you think you're better than us, huh? And they always want to sort of cut you off at the knees. So we have sort of a tough problem here. We love our athletes. We love our heroes to perform unbelievably well. But at the same time, we want them to be unbelievably humble. And those two things don't really go together. And so when we're trying to get athletes pumped up or motivated or just in a psychological emotional state to perform at a very, very high level, you can't be sitting here saying, now I want you to be cool, calm, an average. I want you to be just like everybody else, because if you are, you're helping them become very mediocre. And I've never had anybody call me up in the middle of the night and say, Dr. Winters, I just made the cut here at the Bay Hill Invitational. There wasn't anybody following me. It was the most relaxed, most composed round I've ever had. Can you help me become the most average guy on tour? You know, and the same thing for the ladies. No one calls me up for that. Everyone says, I want to be able to come down the stretch, feel like I'm ready to throw up and just jump out of my shoes. Because when you're feeling like that, that means you're in the hunt. That means you're doing some great stuff. That's confirmation that what you've been doing all day is working. So we have kind of a hard time. And what most people don't realize is that having sort of a healthy arrogance means I believe in what I believe in. You don't have to like me, but I like me. And I've always said this. It's not what other people think about you that's most important. It's what you think about you in the final analysis. And that's about you mastering you, and that's what greatness is all about. It's about you being in control of your thoughts, your emotions, and your life. And is your life taking you where you want to go?
I love that. Now, aside from the confidence issue, what else, what would you say is another top issue that you have to communicate about and deal with these tour players, be it men or women? What would you say is number two?
It's the fear. But it's just not the fear of failing, and it's not the fear of embarrassment, even though Jack Nicklaus said to me one time, his greatest fear was being on like the major championship, like at the Masters, and dubbing it off the first tee. He never really wanted to embarrass himself. In fact, I was talking with Sam Snead about 3 weeks before he would go to the Masters to hit the ceremonial ball. He would be practicing for 2-3 weeks. You know, hitting all these golf balls because he wanted to get up there. And he would always, you know, bend over and go, oh, like, you know, he's like an old man. No, he was a real savvy old fox. He knew exactly what he was doing. And then he'd step up and he'd rip it down there, 250, 260, and everybody would go, oh, my. But the greatest fear that these athletes have, it's the fear of inaccessibility. They will not be able to access the tap because, as you know, as a player, and you go on the golf course and you come in and people go, wow, Ann, that was a great round you had. And you're sitting there thinking, well, thank you. That's, you know, the socially thing. But in your mind, you're going, if you knew how well I really played, it would be a totally different story. And I think that's what happens to a lot of players out here.
That's fascinating. So they're really overachievers if they're thinking like that.
I don't think they're overachievers. I think they're achieving a certain level of excellence that they feel that they can actually do every day. So again, are they misplaced expectations? Are their expectations too high? Because an expectation, Ann, is a preset standard of performance that says, this is the way things have to be. This is the way it should be or could be. And so what I'm trying to do is that expectations a lot of times get in your way. It's like going to a 5-star restaurant, and you go to this 5-star restaurant, you're expected to have great ambiance, great food, great service, and anything less than that is like, well, that's disappointing, because we set ourselves up for failure. And that's really what distorted perfectionism is all about. We have this unbelievable expectation. We've all played with players who, you know, they hit a great shot and everybody goes, great shot. And the perfectionist will come back and go, yeah, I hit it off a little at the toe. I didn't hit it all that good. They're never satisfied. So they never get any good juju, any good mojo out of a good shot.
Right.
So, and they're very hard, you know, to sort of work with. So the athletes, you know, that at this elite level that we're talking about here, like at Bay Hill, getting ready for the Players and the Masters, I mean, they are the best of the best. This is, you know, Top Gun. And when you're like a Top Gun pilot, you have an edge. You have to have an edge. Because if you don't, I mean, you're gone. Because the difference in the sport, in the world of sport, and in the corporate world, and at the very tip top, you know, if you aren't on your game, someone else is going to go around you, and they're going to pass you like you are standing still. Because in this game, an individual sport, it's just you versus the golf course. Everybody says, well, I've got to beat everybody else. Well, everybody's trying to beat everybody else, but it's really not you versus you. It should be you for you. You giving yourself the good stuff so that you can actually, you know, play the very best that you can.
Well, what you're saying is, if I'm hearing you accurately, is, I mean, these are elite athletes. They have expectations for themselves. Somebody says, great shot, they're thinking, I could have done so much better. So are you trying to make them appreciate the good smell of the roses? But they wouldn't really be who they are if they're going to settle for that. You know what I'm saying?
I do. It's a thin line between appreciation and acceptance and then critiquing. You know, what we always say in sports psychology, it shouldn't be, you know, self-destructive criticism. It should be a positive critique. You know, what did I do well right there? But at the end of the day, what do most people do? Oh, I did this wrong, I did that wrong. And so, in hindsight, everything's 20/20. I woulda, coulda, shoulda. What I want my athletes to believe is that this is the best I could do today. I have to accept it. I may not like it. This is the whole thing about acceptance. I may not like it, but it is what it is. And I can't cry over spilt milk. And I'm always telling people that if you want to watch the greatest golf psychology movie in the world, watch Disney's The Lion King. And people go, you got to be kidding. I go, no. Because in The Lion King, when little Simba goes across the elephant graveyard and he's, you know, someplace he didn't want to go, he meets, you know, Timon and Pumbaa, who say, wow, why are you crying? And he says, why he's crying. And he looks at them and goes, well, why are you guys so happy? He goes, because we live by the Zimbabwean philosophy of Hakuna Matata. Since we're in the land of Disney, I'll use Disney here. And that means no worries. Whatever's happened's happened. I'll put it behind me and move forward. And that is a metaphor for life. That's what it is, what it is. Learn from it. Have the maturity of your memories. Have the maturity of that experience and accept it and appreciate it and move on. So for an elite athlete like here at Bay Hill, they've got to appreciate, you know, their good shots. They have to accept their less than perfect shots. They have to accept their misses, and they have to park it and put it behind them and move forward. That's what great athletes do. They live and perform in the moment. Most of us carry our trash with us from shot to shot. And so we're not playing golf, we're playing the game of garbage collection.
What you said, that advice you said, really applies to anybody in any given field, I think. I wanted to pinpoint a couple things you said. Jordan Spieth has been able to handle off the course his ups and downs, I think, in how he handles it, at least in his responses to the media. However, on the course, I think he's just so damn analytical, Doctor, and he just hasn't been able to kind of harness that, the intense determination that he has. You know, I just think he acts out a little too much. I mean, I'm not sure if you ever worked with Jordan Spieth or not, but if you did, what would you say to Jordan Spieth?
Well, the first thing I'd ask Jordan Spieth, I'd say, are you good? And he'd say, well, yes, you know I'm good because I've won major champions. I'm going, well, how did you win them? And he won them by not being so, what I would call, emotional roller coaster. It seems to me a lot of times he actually acts out. He just becomes very vocal. He verbalizes. And he wears his emotions on his sleeve, which is just fine. But you have to have a little bit of balance in this game. And I think what's happened with Jordan, it happened the same with Tom Watson. It happened with a lot of people who didn't start making a lot of their putts because, you know, everyone expected them to make everything they looked at. And people said, what's going on with you? What's happening? How come you're not putting so well? Well, all of a sudden you have to look in the mirror at night and go, Jordan, what's going on with you? And that's when you've got a real problem. When you look in the mirror and the guy or woman who looks back at you and goes, well, I'll tell you what's wrong. You stink. You know, you're terrible, all right? That's when you've really got problems, and that's when it really goes bad. But everyone says, what's wrong? What's wrong? Even in our world today of the iPhone, I mean, at the end of the day, when a player, you know, man, woman, boy, or girl comes off the golf course, I mean, the first thing, you know, that phone just blows up. Boop, 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 boop. You know, hey, I thought you were good. I thought you were going to win this tournament. What happened? What? And next thing you know, that's where the seeds of doubt. Everyone's just starts sort of, and before long, you commit something called emotional Harry Carey. You just overthink. you're distressed, you know, you become disappointed, and then you look around for answers. And a lot of times, you make a mountain out of a molehill. So that's the first thing I would say, you know, with Jordan. I'd say, what is it you want? Where is it you want to go? And let's find out, really. Let's just take it a little bit easier here, because you know how to play the game. But why are we getting, you know, so emotionally volatile here? But maybe that's how he's acting out, because he's putting so much pressure on himself. Maybe that's what we see. We see the manifestation coming out, you know, of him a little bit. But I got to tell you, I've only run into him a couple of times. He seems like a fantastic person, and he'd be one of the people I would love to have a chance, you know, to sit down and work with and talk through, because I always say this one, the great ones always come back. Always. I mean, no matter, you know, if they've been down, and that's the whole point. When you've been at the top of the mountain, and you go down to the bottom floor, you're down in the valley. Once you rise back up, you know, on that ascension to the top of the mountain, you appreciate, you know, the view a whole hell of a lot more.
Wow, he is a lovely guy. I think you're absolutely right, Dr. Winters. I'd love for you to sit down with him and have a chat. Remember all the good times, Jordan, and you'll get there. But don't beat yourself up, because you won so quickly out of the gate. His expectations are just way up, as I'm sure they should be, but that must be tough. That's a whole other issue for another show. How do you handle the highs and lows of this career as, you know, professional golfer or any professional athlete? That's probably so tough.
Well, it is tough, and I think that's why a lot of athletes, they don't like to retire. I mean, that's a whole new area that a lot of, you know, my colleagues are getting into, is sort of the psychological detriment of retiring, because you love the fans, you love the adoration, you love the attention, and then when you're out of the spotlight, you miss, you know, the applause, you miss, you know, the excitement, you miss the adrenaline rush, and for a lot of them, it's hard to step off when you have been at the ultimate peak. And I think somebody who's done this very well, who I've known for many years, who I respect, is Suzanne Pedersen. I mean, she went out, she made that winning putt for the Solheim Cup against Marina Alex, and I mean, that was, she says, this is it, I'm done. You know, I'm a mother, I've achieved this, I've done everything I could in golf, now I'm going to go out and raise my family and my husband and my kids. I think, you know, she did it. She went out on top. I think Peyton Manning is pretty much the same way. I mean, those are two great examples, is that what else do I have to prove? You know, and then you can look back, and it's the memories that keep you warm after all those years. And people come up to you. People are always great about that. They come up to you and go, hey, remember what, you know, 1994 and all that sort of stuff. So that kind of keeps you warm. But I think what happens to a lot of players, they hang on a little bit too.
More time with you, but we are out of time on this segment of Sports Interview. But it's such a pleasure to talk to you. I mean, we could talk about so much more, but we'll get you on again for part two. How's that?
That would be great, Ann. And thanks so much. And kudos to you and all the success you've had in your career. And I understand, you know, now just sitting down with you, why you've had all that success, because you make it really simple and make it very easy for us to sit here and talk to you about what we do and how we do it. So thank you for having me on.
Well, you're very compelling, and I could talk sports psychology always. I mean, I love sports, and I love the psychological aspect of sport and what drives the elite athletes and you know, all the issues that elite athletes face, which really, on a smaller scale, people every day face. You're talking about self-doubt. You're talking about handling the ups and the downs. You're talking about confidence. These are all traits that, you know, this exists from day to day with every human being. So what we're talking, you know, what you're saying about elite athletes really applies to probably every one of our listeners too. So I appreciate your insight, Dr. Winters. Let's do it again. Have fun here at Bay Hill, your hometown, your home course, and would love to have you on again to talk more sports psychology. My thanks to Annika Sorenstam and to Dr. Bob Winters and to our studio engineer, Kyle Lynch. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Stay safe, stay active, stay well. I'll talk to you next Saturday morning right here from 9 to 10 Eastern on Sports Interview with Ann Liguori.